Thank you very much, Dr. Ralston. Good morning. I appreciate those of you that have taken the time to come out this morning. It's a little cold and kind of wintry, but it's a beautiful day. The sun is shining, at least it was as we came in the door, and that's probably a pretty good sign for all of us that the sun is shining. There is an alternative to that, right? Could be that it wouldn't shine, which it wasn't earlier, so it makes us feel better. I want to introduce a few people before we start formally with the remarks. Let's see. Board of Regents members, where's Todd Thacker? Todd's back here toward the back of the room. Todd represents, is elected by the staff to represent the university on the Board of Regents. Royal Burghley is the faculty representative. Royal is in Ireland, I believe, with a group of students on international education study and couldn't be here this morning. Are there any other regents here? Thank you. I would ask that the cabinet stand so we could recognize you as a group, please. The cabinet, would you stand? Thank you. I would ask that the members of the President's Leadership Council stand so that we might recognize you, please. Thank you. Would members of the Faculty Senate stand so we could recognize you, please? Thank you. Would members of the Staff Congress stand so that we could recognize you? So these groups represent the part of our governance structure at the university, and I very much appreciate each of you who choose to participate in these important activities. It makes a difference in terms of how we go as a university. Finally, I'd like to recognize the individuals in my office who provide the day-to-day continuity with respect to all that happens there. Sharon Reynolds and Donna Calvert, would you stand? And John Ernst. John is a member of the cabinet, but John's in the office as well, serves as an executive assistant. Thank you. And last, but certainly not least, my wife, Sue, Morehead State University's First Lady. Would you recognize her, please? Thank you very much. This is an exciting time in our history. And this morning, I thought that I would strike a theme. What I'd like to talk about is honoring our past, living in the present, but acknowledging we're headed into the future, and we need to plan where we're going in the future. So honoring the past, living in the present, planning and anticipating the future. That's sort of the theme that I'd like to discuss with you this morning. I want to accomplish six things. At least it's my intention to do that, and you can judge whether I do or not. First, I'm going to reflect very briefly on our history. Second, I want to spend just a few minutes talking about what we've accomplished working together in the last 10 years. I want to comment on the need for change and how change is affecting us in our lives and what we can anticipate as we go forward. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about our present situation, although I'm not going to plow the ground we've been plowing for the last 5 years, you know, talking about budgets and all the stuff going on, but I'm going to talk a little bit more generally about the present situation. And then I'm going to turn our attention to the future, talk about some of the activities that are going on right now that will help guide us as to where we're headed in the future. And then lastly, I intend to answer your questions. I hope I will be provocative enough to cause some questions from you. So as we think about the past, I hope all of you have taken the opportunity, as I know some of you have because you've spoken with me about it, to read The History of Morehead State University. It's a book written by one of our own retired history professor, former department chair, Don Flatt. It's called The History of Morehead State University, A Light Under the Mountains. And it describes the origins of the place from 1887 through 1996, the first 100 years of the university. It's really well done. We started out as a normal school. We were born in a period in time when there was great problem here in Rowan County. The Rowan County Wars were more significant than the Hatfield and McCoy feud in Pike County, which we hear a lot about. More people died here. There was a lot of ignorance, lack of education, and conflict right here where we live. So in 1887, Frank Button and his wife, Phoebe, came to this community, his mother, Phoebe, not his wife, his mother, and they founded this place, Morehead Normal School. And Dr. Button's picture is right there, as is Allie Young, who was a local legislative leader who provided for many of the resources that made this place happen. So we started out in a humble beginning. Very interesting, during the fall semester, I was handed a yearbook, the first yearbook, the Raconteur from 1927. Now, the place started in 1887, but I'm not going to go through all the history, but in 1922, they shut this place down. In 1923, they reopened this as one of the first state normal schools in Kentucky. And Moorhead was selected in 1923 to be the location of this place. So this Raconteur, 1927, was the first of these yearbooks that was published here. Nelson Gullett, one of our graduates from 1967, gave it to me in honor of his mother, who attended here. And his son, Nelson, is one of our graduates and works in Knoxville at one of the radio stations there. I want to read you just a couple of things from this Raconteur. It's interesting, and I'm going to give this to the folks in the library. They may have one, but it'll go in special collections. So you can go over there and dig it out and read on a little bit if you want. The Moorhead State Normal School and Teachers College is the successor of the Moorhead Normal School, which was founded in 1887 by Mrs. Phoebe Button and her son, F.C. Button, as teachers with one pupil in attendance the first day. They were the first teachers. We had one student. And it happened right where the University Center is, in an old wooden building on the property that's no longer there. That's a pretty humble beginning, isn't it? And then I'm going to skip ahead because there's some other interesting things in here. After many fertile efforts to decide on the location for the new school when we were to become state-supported in 1922, there was a state commission that met in Lexington on November the 25th and named Moorhead as the new home for the new school. It was very contentious, and even today as I travel around, people will tell me it should never have been located here in Moorhead. It should have been in places like Pikeville, Hazard, Mount Sterling, Ashland. It was very contentious if you want to go back and read about it. On September 24th, 1923, so that was the first fall semester when this was a state-supported normal school, the school opened with a faculty of 9 and had less than 100 students. Before the close of the year, the faculty had increased to 13. Boy, we were racing to the top there. And the student body to 250. The second year opened with a faculty of 24 teachers, 5 administrators, and approximately 250 students. Before the close of the third year, the student body numbered 500. During the third year, enrollment escalated to 1,599 students. That's pretty good growth in a short period of time, isn't it? All because people decided education was necessary and important. So if you don't think change is a part of who we are and what we're about, spend a little time on this, and then go to the last Raconteur, which was published probably 5 or 6 years ago. We now do it fully online, and see the difference in what's happening in terms of how we present our university. We've had some colorful presidents in the history of this university. As I've traveled about, one of the most colorful is Adrian Doran. And how many of you were here when Dr. Doran was president? Or here's a student or a faculty member. Several hands going up. Remember Dr. Doran. He was a legendary man. He served as president for 23 years, from 1976, I think, from 1950, Gerald, tell me, 54 through 1976, I think, or 7. It was legendary. If you look at the buildings on the campus, all the residence hall construction, some of the academic buildings, Reed Hall, for example, some of those buildings were built in his tenure. He had great power and a lot of influence. He had been the Speaker of the Kentucky House of Representatives, and he was legendary for his political prowess. But I would say this about Dr. Doran. He was probably the last of the imperial presidents. You know, an imperial president's one that rules with an iron fist, right? You like it or you don't. Well, he had a saying that was, and some of you were here during that time, what was the saying? There's a bus going east and there's a bus going west, and if you don't like what we're doing around here, get on a bus. So this is on display over in the library. This was presented to Dr. Doran by the alumni of the institution in fondness, I think, as he was leaving to say, you know, Dr. Doran, we're going to remember this for a long time. I am not suggesting this morning that you get on a bus going east or west. I only say this as a way for us to recount some of the colorful history of our university. And you talk about change from 1923 when we became public to the point at which Dr. Doran took over in the middle 50s and then through the 70s. There was tremendous change on our university. And so one of the themes I'm going to talk about this morning is change. Today, as you know, we're a regionally accredited public comprehensive university. We have 144 undergraduate programs, 78 graduate programs. The most recent addition was the EDD, the Doctor of Education. So a lot has changed in 127 years, and change we must. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about what we've accomplished in the last 10 years. I'm a great believer in history. I love history. I like to read about it. I like to talk about it. But most importantly, I like to reflect on it, because if we understand history, it certainly helps inform decisions we ought to make today, and it helps inform thoughts about where we might want to go tomorrow. I've just completed my 10th year as president, so I'd like to reflect just briefly on what we've accomplished in those 10 years. Sometimes we get in the muck and we think, you know, the last semester was good or not too good, the last year was great or not too great. But if we want to look at what we've accomplished together, look at a longer period of time. And 10 years seems a reasonable time. So what have we accomplished in the last 10 years together? We've made significant improvements to the infrastructure on this campus, haven't we? If you think about what we've accomplished there, we have renovated 6 residence halls. We spent $28 million doing it. We're getting ready to spend a big chunk of money to continue that process. That's all funded by students, not you as taxpayers, but by students. We've improved technology in classrooms in Rader Hall and Ginger Hall, 2 of our most heavily used classroom buildings. We've improved technology across the campus, and we're getting ready to do more because technology changes and those advances need to be updated. We've improved our roads, in our parking, our water treatment facility, our heating plant. And, you know, some of those things are their backroom things. They're not things that we spend a lot of time worrying or thinking about, but they're essential to what we do in our work here. We've removed 250,000 square feet of old buildings. I mean, think about some of the stuff. Those of you that have been around a long time, there was stuff littered all over this campus that was not being used, it wasn't useful, and it was really a maintenance sink. Todd Thacker told me one time how much money in maintenance costs that represented. I don't remember the number, but it was a big number in terms of the time that his staff had to put into maintaining structures that were of no value. So we've torn all that stuff down. I still have a list, 3 or 4 or 5, that I'd like to take down to improve a little bit more. We have a clear focus today on sustainability. We have more work to do, but think about it. We've moved from heating the central plant with coal to using natural gas. We've done 3 major energy-saving projects for lighting, for control systems in buildings, and I know it's not perfect, but we have come a long way. We have a robust recycling program that's going to get better. We're concerned about the environment, and we know that you and our students believe that we should do more in this area, and we're committed to it. In these 10 years, we've added about 300,000 square feet of new space. In fact, we built 2 new academic buildings in the last 10 years, the first built since Dr. Doran was here. We built the Center for Health Education and Research, a $30 million building on 2nd Street as you come into campus, which is home for nursing, imaging sciences, and all the other things there in partnership with the hospital and the University of Kentucky. We built the Space Science Facility, a $16 million facility, which is a state-of-the-art facility that enables us to have that program earning international recognition for the work that our faculty, our staff, and our students are doing there. We added a new surgery suite at the Derrickson Agricultural Complex, the University Farm, and it's a state-of-the-art large animal hospital. You got a sick horse or a cow? Bring it in. We added 300 acres to the inventory of our campus. The Browning Orchard was a donation by the Browning family. It's in Fleming County. It's a beautiful place in Wallingford, Kentucky, and it is a laboratory for our students in the agriculture department. And through private gifts, we purchased and added to our inventory Eagle Trace Golf Course. So we have done a lot with the campus infrastructure. But more importantly for most of us, I suppose, is the curriculum. When I came to the university, the curriculum here, like many places, was really too large for a student to accomplish in 4 years. Part of the dilemma for our students, you can't graduate from college if your program has 136 hours, unless you go to summer school or do other special things. And we had some programs that had that many and some a few more hours than that. The Board of Regents directed us, and we followed through, and we renovated all of this curriculum back into a 120-hour format. There may be a few programs that have slightly more, but we're basically at 120 hours. And we say to students, 15 hours a semester for 8 semesters, and you can graduate in 4 years, right? And we should be telling students that day in and day out to help keep them on track. As part of that process, then, we reduced the number of hours in general education by 25%, a very significant shift there for all of us. During these 10 years, we achieved SAC's reaffirmation. That's a 10-year reaffirmation process, extremely important to the institution. You can't offer programs unless you have regional accreditation. You can't receive Title IV funds for financial aid unless you're regionally accredited. And because of the good work that you do, we came through that reaffirmation in good shape. And our faculty spent a lot of time creating a quality enhancement plan related to critical thinking, and that plan is being worked through the freshman year seminar, and I think we're making a difference there. We've placed significant effort in the last 10 years and attention to recruitment, retention, and graduation. You know, for us, this is extremely important because students come to this university for lots of reasons, but our goal is to educate them and help them graduate. We've invested significant resources in advising, in systems and processes to try to make this a better place for our students. We are not there yet. It'll be a continuous process, but there's a lot of effort that's going on in this area in the last 10 years. And finally, I would note that we've had a major revision to our strategic plan. It's a very good plan, well-developed, and many of you participated in that through shared governance, a very important opportunity. And this last year, we revised the campus master plan. Significant undertaking. So across these last 10 years, have we accomplished much? I would say we have accomplished a lot working together for the benefit of the students that we serve from our region, from the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and throughout the nation. And if you think about it, we've accomplished all this during one of the most difficult economic periods in our history. The recession, which began in 2006, arguably is the most significant economic downturn since the Great Depression. And there are only a couple of people in here that lived through that, Gerald and I'm not going to mention another guy up in the back there, but that was pretty tough going, wasn't it, Gerald? A lot of tato soup and stuff like that. But we got through it. Gerald's a good straight guy and get away with that for right now. I may not later. But, you know, when going into it, we didn't know what we were getting into, did we? But it was pretty darn tough all across the United States. In some of our counties, Menifee County would be an example. Owsley would be another. Morgan County. We had unemployment during that recessionary period that was as high as 25%. There were a lot of people struggling to put food on the table to make ends meet. And yet here at Morehead State University, we were able to keep everybody employed, which was my goal, and I kept telling you that, keep everybody employed, maintain our benefits program, which we did, and we even provided salary increases, and we created, at the end of this recession, a new compensation plan. Occasionally somebody will say to me, well, we haven't had a pay raise in so long around here, I just don't understand it. And I'm generally polite, but reflect on what I just said. During the greatest recessionary period in this country, we did all of those things. And we did, in fact, provide pay raises for people in most of the years. There were 2 years when we didn't do anything. But in most of those years, there was some form of pay remuneration for our people. And we maintained everybody's benefits, and we kept everybody working. And that's a testament to you because we kept focus on our students. We knew what we had to do, and that was educate those we're here to take care of. These accomplishments, though, highlight the importance of planning our work, working our plan, and working together. If we will continue to do those three things, there's no limit to what we can accomplish. Plan our work, work our plan, and work together. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said this, "To reach a port, we must sail." Sail, not tie at anchor. Sail, not drift. We haven't been drifting. We've stayed in the middle of the channel the best we've known how, and we've set a course to a preferred future. Most of us are on the boats going in the same direction, not all of us. And so I hope this morning, and as we talk about our future, we'll get on the same boat and feel more like we should work together. Let me talk just a minute about where we are without retreading a lot of stuff we've talked about in the past. I could spend the next hour on budget. You've heard all that. I could talk about retention. You've heard all that. I could talk about the need to do some things. You've heard all that. So I'm not going there. But I want to hit a few highlights about where we are right now. We are a state-assisted public institution. I use that language carefully, state-assisted. We used to be state-supported. I have some colleagues across the country that refer to their institutions as state-located. And it all has to do with the amount of money we're receiving from our state governments. When I came here 10 years ago, about 60% of the cost of an education at Morehead State University was provided by the Commonwealth. Today it's 38 or 9%. And across the United States that's happened. In fact, Jamie Hornbuckle sent me a study that was summarized in the Huffington Post, but it was from the Government Accounting Office recently done, that said in 2012, across the United States, we've passed that demarcation place where tuition is paying the largest part of a public higher education in the United States. That happened in 2012. In fact, the number that jumped off the page, in the time period from 2003 to 2012, the state contribution per FTE student fell from a high of 6,211 in 2003 to 4,695 in 2012. And that was during an era when there was a 20% increase in participation in higher education. So what's happening is the investment that states are making in higher education is truly on the decline, and we've seen it in our own state. I heard on public radio this morning as I was going into campus that in the state of Ohio, the Speaker of the House made the proclamation that he's asking higher education to reduce their budgets by 5%. He said, we're not talking about a cap, we're not talking about a freeze, we want them to reduce their budgets by 5%. Is higher education the problem, or is higher education the solution to the problems we face as a country? What do you think? I hope you're thinking, my God, it's a solution. If we want to keep people out of jail, educate them. If we want to keep people more healthy, educate them. If we want people to participate in this great democracy, educate them. We need to be saying that to our elected representatives over and over and over in every way that we can. The conventional wisdom today is going like this. There's a shift in the public's perception of the value of education, isn't there? I've read more articles this last year from folks that are saying, why go to college? You can't get a job. Why go to college? You won't earn any money. And that is absolutely not true. The data is very clear. It's been documented in very thorough scientific studies done by people in our business saying, if you want the best life, go to college and get an education. If you want to earn the best money, go to college and get an education. In fact, during the Great Recession, the categories of people least out of work were those folks that had the most education. It's been well documented. But there's some of this in the literature about the value of that. And then what about the whole notion? What about the whole notion that higher education is a public good? When I was a young person, and many of you, when you were young, not everybody got a chance to go to college, right? And we got pushed along or pulled along to go to school because it was in the interest of our country to educate people. Today, there's a shift in public perception about that's more of a personal right than a public good. I hope you believe it's a public good, and I hope you will invest your energy in talking about that with people that make a difference. There's some things happening, though, at the present that are challenging for us, shift in demographics. In the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen nationally about 2 to 3% of the pipeline of students going into higher ed begin to shrink by 2 or 3%, meaning there are fewer kids coming out of high school going to college. In our service region, it's even more significant than that because of shifting demographics and loss of work. As the extractive industries in our region have struggled in the last few years, many families have left the region. They've had to. It's had a great impact on some of the public schools in the region, and that will have an impact on us. So demographics are changing, and we've got to pay attention to it. There's more competition today. We've talked about that before, but it's competition among the publics. Look at the advertisements. Last night late, I was watching television, and I saw 2 advertisements in a row from EKU. Our sister institution, and they were very high-quality advertisements about why students should choose Eastern. We have some of our advertisements on television, but everybody else does as well. Last year, when enrollments in Kentucky were down across the Commonwealth, the University of Kentucky saw its largest freshman class with 5,000 students. So if you look nationally at what's happening, what you see is that the storied land-grant institutions that are really trying to do some things different and be innovative, they're doing very well. The comprehensive universities are the universities that are struggling for lots of reasons. We have to pay attention to that. And finally, I would comment in this present environment that accountability is more and more here for us. It used to be accountability. When I first got into the business, the first SAC self-study that I was involved in the very early 90s was about how many books do you have in the library? How many students are you recruiting to your campus? How many students receive financial aid? It was all about inputs. Today, nobody's asking about inputs. They're asking about outputs. How many students are graduating from your university? How many years does it take to graduate? How much debt are they carrying? Are they graduating into a field where there is work? What's the average salary? Are they staying in their home state? It's a whole new series of output measures, and they're things that we absolutely have to pay attention to. Let me talk a little bit about change. I did something different this morning because I'm fond of saying, how many of you got up this morning and changed something? Robin, did you change anything this morning? I love that. She used her second snooze alarm to read in the book. That's great. Well, I get up every morning and do all the stuff that I do, and then I have a little cup of yogurt and an apple and some orange juice and a cup of coffee. This morning I made an egg. Only because I couldn't find any apples. I ate them all yesterday. So I got out. We had some nice raspberry muffins, and I cut the middle out of one and put it in a little frying pan that I got for Christmas last year and dropped an egg in there. God, it was good. And then I went on MyFitnessPal and realized that was only 93 calories. So I'm off and running. Change is a topic that's interesting, it's informative, and yet for many of us it's tough. Change is all around us. We're immersed in it every day of our lives, and yet most of us resist certain changes, particularly those in and around our workplace. But what's happening to us is change is the constant in our world, and the pace of change continues to accelerate. We don't like it necessarily, but it's happening. I was having a conversation with a colleague the other day about the whole smartphone business. How many of you have a smartphone? Yeah, most everybody in the room has one. Heck, you can use it as your tape recorder. Who has a tape recorder anymore? You can use it as your metronome if you want to see how you're playing in time. You can use it to tune your banjo. Banjos need a lot of tuning, banjos and chainsaws. And you can use it to take pictures. You can think about it. But you can also use it to be in constant communication with anybody you want to be. If you want to send text messages at 2 o'clock in the morning to your best friend, you can do it. If you want to call people all over the world, you can do it. Think about how that one device has altered the way we do a lot of things. Change is accelerating, and some of that is not necessarily helpful to us. It may be causing us great anxiety. We have an ambitious change agenda at Morehead State University. I've heard through the last couple of years people saying we're sick and tired of changing stuff. We ought to just settle down and do it one way. If we settle down and do stuff one way, we're standing still. And if we're standing still, people that we are in competition with are moving on past. We've discussed many facets of change in the past, not specifically under that moniker, but we've talked about some of these. Change is important to us because it's what's going to make us relevant in a fast-paced world. Let me say it again. Change is important because it's what's going to make us relevant in a changing world. Things are changing all around us, and if we want to maintain our relevance, we have to decide what to change, when to change, and how to change. But let me be clear about this. This change agenda is not Wayne's agenda. It's our agenda. You've participated in this. I asked at the very beginning for different groups to raise up, show yourself, the cabinet, the President's Leadership Council, the Faculty Senate, the Staff Congress. You've all participated, individual faculty members. We had the best participation in our strategic planning process last year than we've had in any planning process since I've been here. People took time to really get engaged in that. And we're not done. The framework has been created, but all the elements in that plan now have to be input, and they'll be input through you in the various departments and units on campus. You're part of the change agenda. It's our agenda. It's not Wayne's agenda. Many of you have helped shape it, and I hope you're going to want to continue to shape it because it's where the work's got to continue. When you came into the room today, we had some images on the screen. They were there simply to tickle your imagination, to get you to think about how this place has changed dramatically in 127 years. And it's a good thing. I think if old Dr. Button came back today, he would be amazed, wouldn't he? To see what he and his mother started here and what it has helped do. 65,000 alumni have graduated from this place. 6,000 to 7,000 still live in the region. We have had senators, congressmen, physicians of great acclaim, lawyers, dentists, teachers, superintendents, business leaders, every walks of life, people have graduated from this place with great pride. And we've got to continue to do that. Change is an integral part of our history. But I would be the first to say change can be disruptive if it's not managed and approached properly. If we think about it as an obstacle to avoid rather than an opportunity to embrace. Winston Churchill, who was one of the great leaders in Europe during the Second World War, said this, "A pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty." Part of that is adjusting how we think about what we face. As we move forward, I'd like you to consider the following things. Our goal is to build on what's gone before. I'm not suggesting we have revolution. I'm suggesting we continue to evolve, but evolve purposefully according to our plan. Plan our work. Work our plan. We have to be willing to renew and adapt to the changing environment that we're in. To renew and adapt. To acknowledge things are different. To acknowledge things change. To acknowledge the relevance of some of what we do may be shifting. Progress has always come through people. That's us. We're not going to see progress coming to us from state government. We're not going to see progress coming to us from some form of technology that's just set on a table. Progress comes from people, the good people that work here. That's you and me. People drive innovation. People willing to respond to student needs make a big difference. Our guide is our strategic plan, Aspire. It's a good plan. You helped create it. And there are two core principles in that plan that are essential to our success. The first is academic excellence. And the second is student success. And as we move forward and flesh those ideas out, we have to be mindful of what we really should focus on. Students must always come first. You know, occasionally, when we have conversations, we tend to talk about us, me, my stuff. Sometimes the student's not even in the conversation, not part of the equation. None of us would be here. None of what we do in the main would be relevant if it were not for our students. Students must come first. They're the reason that we exist. We must ensure that our students leave here with those critical thinking and analytic skills that will enable them to be successful wherever they go in whatever field. And we know, because of your disciplinary training, whatever that is, we know that in some ways it's not as important whether your degree is in philosophy or applied engineering. It's more important what the content is in the courses that you take. We know that students have to be able to communicate well, orally, in writing. They have to be able to discern facts from difficult arguments. They have to be able to advance arguments of their own and defend positions. That's the heart of what a good quality liberal arts core in an education does for students, and it's essential. That is not going to change, but how we do that may change. But hear me on this point. Academic programs have a shelf life. Let me say that again. Academic programs have a shelf life. Have you gone into your cupboard lately and pulled something out and looked at the date on there and it was out of date? Happens to me all the time. And then the question is, well, should I do it or not? Sue sometimes says, yeah, the milk's only 3 days old. I think you can do it. And then I give it the sniff test. I think, I ain't doing it. Academic programs have a shelf life. Boy, we don't like, I mean, that's foreign language for us. I should have gone back to my French and said it in French because that smacks you right in the face. We, most of us in the academics, on the academic side, we grew up in a discipline. We learned about the discipline, the facts, the principles, the ideas in the discipline, and we believe that's all relevant for a long time, perhaps forever. But the programs have a shelf life. One of the things we've learned through critical self-analysis is some of our programs are not valued by our students. How do we know that? They don't take them. They're not enrolled in them. They're not majors in them. Some of them are not valued by our employers. How do we know that? Because they're not hiring those students. And so we have to be smart enough to look at what we're doing and engage in a process of review that's continuous where we ask ourselves the question, are these programs relevant for the world in which we live today, but more importantly, the world we're preparing students to enter into the future? We have to adjust our thinking. So maybe tomorrow you fry an egg. Maybe you look at the date on your yogurt. Or maybe you think about the content of a course or a program and you ask yourself the question, or you ask your colleagues a question, or more importantly, you look in the literature and you start probing who's hiring these students and are they being successful. We must embrace a culture of innovation. This country has always thrived on innovation. I grew up in a little New England town that was part of the Industrial Revolution in this country. We manufactured boots. We invented the sewing machine and the spring bed. Down the road in Connecticut, the whole modern manufacturing system was created through the arms industry and clock manufacturing, where we learned about interchangeability and standardization. And when brass was in short supply, those New England Yankees use wood to make gears for clocks. I've got some in the house if you want to come look at them. But the point is not that. The point is about innovation. If you want to move something forward, you've got to ask people to innovate. And we're going to ask you to innovate as we look at some of our academic programs. The culture of innovation is important. People drive innovation, and it needs to be based on student needs. Right now, we're experiencing tough times in Eastern Kentucky. What are the needs in our communities? How do we create opportunities that will create employment possibilities for the people that we're charged to serve? We've lost more than 7,000 jobs in the last year in the extractive industries. Many believe that the majority of those jobs are not coming back. We live in a knowledge-based economy. What can we contribute to in that regard? Bob Albert and some of his team in business are starting a whole center around entrepreneurship. They've partnered with the people from the Economic Development Cabinet, the Economic Development Council, the city, the county, and we're going to open a business incubator called the Launch Pad on Main Street in Moorhead, probably in February, and we're going to try our best to be an engine for innovation, to create opportunity for smart people who have ideas to start businesses and push them out into the region so they can create opportunity for employment. We've got to think about how to do this in many, many ways. Do we listen to the people that are employing our students? The department that I'm tenured in, which is Applied Engineering and Technology, AZ could be my boss one day. AZ, raise your hands so everybody knows who you are. There he is right there. He could do my evaluation downstream here. AZ's department is the best on campus that I've seen in terms of listening to the people that hire their students. They have a large, robust advisory group. They meet on a regular basis, and those people are involved in looking at the courses, the content of the courses, in terms of how we deliver the instruction and whether that meets their needs in the labor market. We're not a trade school, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating that. I'm advocating we listen to the people that employ our students to make sure that we're arming them with the appropriate knowledge, skills, attitudes, and dispositions necessary for success. We need to look across departments, to look across colleges, and to look across other institutions to find the collaborations that make sense to advance what our people need. Collaboration, I believe, is going to be a very, very important key to our long-term success. No institution of public higher ed can continue to be a tub onto its own bottom and ignore everybody else's tub that's floating on by. Where can we link up with our partner institutions, public or private, and add the leverage of bright people, faculty, and other resources to deliver what needs to be taught in a time and place that's relevant? A number of individuals and groups on this campus are deeply involved in innovation, and you always run the risk when you list things, because I always hear from people after the fact and say, well, you know, my department, we're doing this and you didn't mention it, so I apologize in the beginning that I didn't mention your department, but I'm going to mention a few. But the important part about this comment is every one of these innovative things involves you. It involves faculty. It involves our people, our staff. The people are the engine for change and innovation. It doesn't happen without you. So we have a Master of Arts degree in English fully online. It's doing pretty well. It's not been without a few rocks in the road, but it's doing pretty darn well. And that didn't just happen. Phil Crumrick, Lane Nieper, Tom Williams, and the English faculty made it happen. It wasn't a mandate from the president of the university. They got together and said, you know what, this is important. Let's figure out how to do this. We have a program out at the university farm called Farm to Table. We've entered into a partnership with Aramark, our food service provider on campus, that we raise prize Angus beef on the farm, and we sell it to Aramark. They also buy our vegetables and fruit and other things, and the goal there is to bring a sustainable products to the campus so we can consume them, and our students like it. I like it. I eat that stuff, and it's really good. It wouldn't have happened without Joe Fraley, and Joe's the farm manager, and some of the faculty in that department. We created a few years ago a Bachelor of Science degree in Biomedical Sciences out of the biology department. Darren DeMoss, Doug Dennis, Craig Turk, Jeff Garner, faculty in biology took a bold step. we have a very, very significant and successful program in preparing students to go into the professions of medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, and the like. And they took the bold step to say biomedical science is the curriculum, it's the path to do that. And they did it knowing full well that some in the disciplinary strands of entomology and herpetology and others, we might see some reduction in courses offered there to benefit the majority. It was the right decision at the right time. Although I know there was some controversy around it, I'm pleased we did it and we will stay the course. We have currently a rural dentistry initiative going on our campus because of Gerald Amos, working with Rainer Mullins, retired dean from the University of Kentucky. And it's all about trying to improve the oral health of people in our region. You know, people that have little don't go to the doctor a lot. They don't take care of themselves. And oral health care has been linked to tremendous health disparities. Through Gerald's leadership and funding from the Appalachian Region Commission, we've had significant funding, approaching $1 million to develop curriculum on our campus with the biology folks and at the University of Kentucky to create a pipeline for students that want to go into dentistry. And we recently finished up the renovation of a dental clinic and the student health clinic. So now students can come on our campus as our students, and when they go over to the clinic to have whatever checkups they need done, we can do oral checkups. A lot of health disparities grow out of poor oral care. And this is money that came to us because Gerald and others were smart about raising money through the ARC, the Appalachian Region Commission, through grants. We're embarking on, in the Department of Applied Engineering and Technology, a Center for Advanced Manufacturing. A Center for Advanced Manufacturing. We just had a grant from the James Graham Brown Foundation for $500,000, and we've had it matched with private donations. We've got almost $1 million now, so we can create a facility that will be a leading facility for our students to learn about advanced manufacturing. So it will involve lots of complex things beyond what I understand. If I were to go back there today, I got to go retool. But AZ told me he'd help me at nights and on the weekends. Right, AZ? He looks reluctant to buy into that one. Maybe that won't work. But this is what we need. Toyota's investing $500 million in Georgetown to bring a new assembly operation to Kentucky to produce the Lexus 350. It's going to start in 2016, I think. What they need are students coming to them as graduates that are highly skilled in modern technology applications. The day of the old welder and machine operator and all that, that's done. These people have to be sophisticated in just-in-time manufacturing and robotics and pneumatics and hydraulics and micro miniaturization and optimization and things that are really cutting-edge topics, and we need a facility here that will enable that to be done. At the Kentucky Center for Traditional Music, Raymond McLean has partnered with Jennifer Reese, and they are involved in something called arts entrepreneurship. I am really blessed to have a daughter who's an artist. Jill is a performing artist. She's a singer and a songwriter in Nashville. One thing artists struggle with is how you make a living, right? How many of you know an artist? We all know some. I get a little emotional because I love Jill. She's been at it full time for 10 years and she's doing pretty well. But what artists don't normally have is a business aptitude, right? I've watched Jill get on a bus, get in a van, and head off across country to do a gig that probably paid $300. Where's the economics in that? And you can be a wonderful wood carver, banjo builder, but if you don't understand how to do business, how to market, how to optimize your work, you're not going to make a living. So I'm proud of Raymond and Jennifer because they're offering courses that will help our artists become more skillful at the business, on the business side of this. Robert Borum, a long-term faculty member in physics and science education, is working with April Haight, and they're trying to develop more outside classrooms on this campus that benefit students that are studying science. There's a lot to learn in our environment, and we ought to be doing some of it in the outside environment, and they're working at it. Convergent Media is a fairly new program on this campus, and I'll tell you what, I've been really, 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 really pleased. We hired John Flavel. John here? If he's not, we'll gig him up. John's standing in the back up there, leaning up against the post. John worked at the Asheville Independent newspaper for many years, and I was going to say he's kind of a curmudgeon, but I won't say that because he's here. He was a photographer there for many, many years and part of their staff. We hired John as an adjunct faculty member. When I first saw him on campus, I said, John, what are you doing here? He said, I'm working for you. He said, well, I shouldn't say that. You're not paying me enough, but I'm working here. John is doing a terrific job in that program working with our students, and they're getting their material published in the Asheville Daily Independent, in the Lexington Herald, published online. Their video work as well as their written work. I've seen this last semester, I don't know, 10 pieces maybe, Keith, a lot. And that's just an example of hiring the right person that's in the business that understands what we need to do to help a program move along. That program's going places. Our legal study program is 9 out of 25 such programs in the country. It's a terrific program. Two faculty members involved in that, Kelly Collinsworth and Diana Murphy. I think this year we may have added another staff member, but these students are being very successful. Again, this is about innovation, and it's about you, our faculty, leading it. I probably need not say anything about space science. We talk about it a lot. Some think I'm stuck on it. It's the only thing I know. It's not the only thing I know. It just happens to be a program that has earned international recognition. But the work there is being done by our faculty and our staff, and it is terrific work, influencing the lives of students. And these young people are being promoted forward so that they'll have really well-paying jobs in the future. And think about the Kraft Academy for Excellence in Science and Mathematics. That idea was born out of people. It's an innovative idea. Why couldn't we have on our campus a high school that would be for excellent students interested in science and math that would enable us to recruit 60 high school juniors? We're in the process now. We'll be selecting them in February. The first class will start in the fall. And then the following year, we'll add 60 more, so we'll have a total of 120 students, fully funded by the Kentucky General Assembly and an appropriation of $2.3 million in the last session. But for us to be successful with that, the faculty need to teach those students in ways that are really exciting and thought-provoking, because these will be among the best students anywhere. The bottom line is, it doesn't happen without you. Now, I haven't mentioned much about staff, but let's talk about that for just a minute. The heart of the business is the faculty, right? Students come here to get an education, and the faculty deliver that for the most part. Staff are involved in educating as well. But you can't fly an airplane unless you have people that know how to repair it, fuel it, sell tickets, handle baggage, get you wherever you're going on time, and everything that goes with it. Our staff do all of that and more here. They maintain our buildings and grounds, our heating plant, our water plant, our roads. They account for all of our money. They provide leadership to administration. They hire, they evaluate, they terminate. They keep our buildings clean. They keep everything repaired. We couldn't offer an education without our staff. And I very much appreciate them as much as I appreciate our faculty. Let me turn my attention now to the future. It's obvious we're in the midst of continuing change. I think you know that. I know it, but it's good to remind ourselves. And I know that with change comes anxiety and hopeful anticipation. Anxiety is not an unnatural thing. We're anxious about a lot of things. But hopeful anticipation is the other side of that coin. I've had as many people say to me, boy, I'm tired of change, as I've had people say, man, it's about time we get some of this stuff done. I'm looking forward to participating. That's the hopeful anticipation side of it. The anxiety is about how's it going to affect me personally. That's really what it's always about, right? You can change anything you want as long as you don't move my cheese. But if you move mine, then it kind of bothers me. I understand that. I've had my cheese moved around a lot in the last 40 years. Hopeful anticipation, though, is about creating a better university for us as employees, but most importantly, for our students as we try to define our path to a preferred future. Most of you are aware that an academic self-study is underway. Last fall, I directed Dr. Ralston, our provost, and the academic leadership to undertake a self-study to examine ways that we could be more efficient and effective. The process is essential for a variety of reasons. Now, some might be thinking, man, we keep doing this stuff. We keep digging and we keep trying to change. Yeah, we've done some things. But the truth of the matter is the majority of adjustments on this campus in the last 10 years have been on the administrative side of the house. We've reorganized, we've reallocated, we've downsized, we've upsized in some area, but the majority of change has been on the administrative side of the house. On the academic side, this study is essential for the following reasons. First, we've got to eliminate a structural budget deficit of $1.5 million. I've told you before, we're not in a fiscal crisis. The problem is this. The tuition revenue that we bring in, plus the state general fund appropriation that we're provided, do not equal the cost to run the place. So that's like your paycheck, your significant other's paycheck is what you have coming in, and your bills exceed that. Now, the way we've managed that in the past is we're careful every year as to how we allocate our money, how we spend our money, and we carry forward money every year. And when we carry that money forward, we invest some of it in the budget for the subsequent year. So we've been able to manage a structural deficit in that manner, but that's not a model that's sustainable for the future. So we've got to reduce the budget on the academic side by $1.5 million. In addition, we've got to create efficiencies. We are organized in certain ways because we've organized in certain ways. We've chosen to do that, right? We have colleges, we have departments, we have a few schools, we have whatever we have. Not mandated by the Board of Regents, not mandated by the General Assembly. Decisions made on this campus over time. And I think everybody would agree that there is an opportunity for us to be more efficient in terms of how we organize and how we use our resources. But make no mistake about it, efficiency will enable us to address strategic priorities. So this isn't about trying to be more efficient to be more efficient. This is being more efficient to eliminate a structural deficit that will enable us to reallocate money to other priorities, like our strategic plan, like the development of new programs that are essential in the world we live in today, like the funding of the employee compensation plan, which we will face the third phase of that in this upcoming budget. But if we don't do that, we will not have the resources necessary for those things. This self-study is important to ensure that current academic programs meet the needs of students, employers, the Commonwealth, and folks across the United States that are going to employ our students. If we have programs that are out of date, let's sunset them. Let's reorganize them. Let's rebrand them. But let's not continue to do what we're currently doing if it doesn't make sense. At the center of all this process is the APNA process. It's looking at institutional data to make institutional decisions, plus some other data. But the reality is when we did the curriculum audit 7 years ago, whenever that was, we didn't have as good of institutional data as we have today. Today we know, based on every program at the university, how the program is performing, how many majors are involved, how many credit hours are generated by the faculty in that unit, whether they're full-time, tenure-track faculty, whether they're fixed-term faculty. We know how much release time in every program. We know about everything we need to know about programs. And the question is, are we willing to use the data to make decisions? And the answer from me is absolutely. It's the only way to make decisions. Those of you that know me that have been around the last 10 years or so know that generally I'm an optimist by nature. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have days that aren't good. just like you, I have some days where I just soon go to the house. Or maybe some days where I just soon stay at the house. Or maybe some days when I'd like to leave the house. But generally, I'm an optimist by nature. I'm kind of a glass half full guy. I see opportunities in difficulty. President Roosevelt, FDR, said, attitude is a little thing that makes a big difference. Isn't that the truth? Attitude is a little thing that makes a big difference. You want to be around people with a positive attitude or somebody that as soon as you get around them, you want to grab your coffee and get out of the room because they drag you down. Who gets to choose our attitude? We do. Nobody can force me to have a good one or a bad one. I get to choose. In fact, if you look at successful people in any walk of life, whether it be athletics or business, they're generally people that have great attitudes. They believe in the power of working together and getting things done. A faculty member here at this university a couple years ago sent me this quote after I made some comments at a convocation. Kind of like the quote. It's a little dicey, but I hope you'll take it in the spirit in which it's intended. It's from Sam Rayburn. Sam was a legendary speaker of the United States House of Representatives from Texas, I think. And Sam said this. He said, any jackass can tear down a barn, but it takes a good carpenter to build one. I'd ask you to join me in becoming good carpenters. As we plan our future, as we work toward creating a better future for this university, build it together. Let's carpenter the thing. Let's use our skills and our knowledge and our abilities to work together to build it. That doesn't mean we won't have robust discussion. Doesn't mean we won't disagree, but it means we'll be purposeful and we'll be positive. Thank you for being here this morning. Thank you for all you do for Morehead State University. I look forward to working with you in 2015 as we strive to make this place the best public regional university in the South.